All right, so diving in today, we're going deep on this case, State v. Cotton from way back in 1979, Idaho Supreme Court, right?
Yep, that's the one.
And this one, I think, is a really good example, kind of a microcosm even, of some big concepts we see all the time in the law.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely foundational stuff here.
Yeah, and we've got a pretty good set of sources too. I mean, we've got the actual opinion from the Idaho Supreme Court,
You've
plus
got those concurrences.
yes, from Justices Bakes and Bisline. They always bring something interesting to the table.
Oh, yeah. Definitely going to spice things up a bit.
And then, just to kind of round it all out, we've also got a pretty standard case brief, just to make sure we hit all the main points.
Exactly. Nice and organized.
So for anyone listening, think of this deep dive like a crash course in, well, how the pieces of our justice system really fit together.
Yeah, perfect way to put it.
Freddie Cotton, the guy at the center of this whole thing, he was convicted on a few different charges. Robbery.
What they called back then, infamous crime against nature.
Right. Which, and let me just clarify for anyone, that was basically Idaho's way of saying sodomy back in 79.
Exactly. Times change, laws change, right.
They do. And also kidnapping. And these were all concurrent sentences, which, just as a reminder.
Means they're served at the same time.
Yep, exactly. So
Yeah.
what we're going to explore today are questions I think everyone's probably wondered at some point. Like, can a judge just decide, nope, I don't believe this witness, and just toss out the whole case?
Right, like what's the limit on that?
Exactly. And then there's this whole reasonable doubt thing. What actually makes a good jury instruction on that? Or a bad one?
Yeah, that's always a debate.
It really is. And then lastly, just how much power does a judge actually have when it comes to handing down a sentence?
Lots to unpack there.
For sure. So starting with that first one about the believability of a witness. So Cotton, his whole defense, it really boiled down to saying, look, the victim's story just doesn't add up.
Yeah, he basically claimed it was so inconsistent, so unbelievable.
That it shouldn't even have gone to the jury.
Exactly.
And the Idaho Supreme Court, their response to that is pretty interesting, I think, because it really highlights a crucial principle about who decides the facts of a case.
Oh, for sure. And it's not the judge, right?
Right. No matter what the judge personally thinks about a witness, it's the jury's job to figure out if they're telling the truth. Like, that's their whole purpose.
Right. The jury is the fact finder. They hear the witnesses, see how they act, and then they piece it all together.
Yeah, and the Idaho Supreme Court, they made it crystal clear. For an appeals court to just come in and overturn what a jury decided based on the evidence.
The bar is set really, really high.
Super high. Like, there has to be basically zero solid evidence supporting the jury's verdict.
Yeah, it can't just be, oh, the story's a bit shaky.
Right. There has to be nothing there at all.
Exactly.
So even if a witness's testimony, I don't know, maybe it contradicts itself in places or there are some gaps.
But doesn't automatically mean the judge can just chuck it out.
Right. And there's this line from the court's opinion that kind of sums it up perfectly. It says, where there is competent, although conflicting evidence to sustain the verdict, this court cannot reweigh that evidence or disturb the verdict.
Powerful stuff. And what I think is really smart about that is it shows this clear separation of duties, you
Oh,
know?
yeah, I see what you mean.
It's like, okay, think of a science experiment, right? The trial court, they set up the experiment, they make sure everything's done by the book, get all the evidence, the testimony.
And the jury, they analyze the results. They draw a conclusion.
Exactly. And then the appeals court, their job is to check if the experiment was run correctly.
But they don't get to, like, redo the whole experiment.
Right, or question the conclusions the jury came to, unless there was some fundamental flaw in the process.
That's a really good analogy. It helps make sense of why we have this system in the first place.
Yeah, the jury, they're the ones who are there. They saw it all firsthand.
So, moving on. Next big issue in this case, the always fun and sometimes confusing topic of reasonable doubt. Now, the trial court in Cotton, they use their own instruction to explain this to the jury, not the standard one.
Right, and the Idaho Supreme Court, they'd already kind of hinted that they liked this one instruction, CLGC 2.90. It's from California, actually.
Yeah, I've seen that one. It uses phrases like abiding conviction, moral certainty.
Tough like that. Trying to give jurors a better grasp of just how much doubt is enough to acquit.
But the trial court in Cotton, they went off script.
They did.
And now you'd think maybe the Supreme Court would just say, nope, wrong instruction, case over.
Right, automatic reversal.
But they didn't.
Not this time.
They did say, look, the instruction wasn't ideal. Like, it was missing some of those key phrases that CLG 2.90 has.
Right, not as clear as it could be.
But they decided that in this specific case, It wasn't so bad that it totally messed up the trial.
They basically said, look, we're not overturning the conviction this time, but...
But from now on, everybody better use CalGD 2.90.
Exactly. A little slap on the wrist, but a firm message for the future.
And this is where those concurring opinions from Bakes and Bisline, they really get interesting. Because they weren't totally convinced that CalGD 2.90 was the be-all and end-all solution.
Yeah, Justice Bakes, he raised a really thought-provoking point. He wondered if all these fancy legal phrases we use to define reasonable doubt...
If they actually help jurors or just make things more confusing.
Right. Like, maybe the phrase reasonable doubt is already clear enough on its own, everyday language.
And he even had this great line in his opinion. He said, the phrase reasonable doubt may be sufficiently self-explanatory without attempts at further definition that risk causing more confusion.
I love that. And Justice Bisline, he was on the same page basically saying, maybe jurors just, you know, they get it. They understand reasonable doubt on a gut level without all the legal mumbo jumbo.
So here you have this situation where even the top judges in the state,
they can't agree on the best way to explain this super fundamental legal concept.
Right. It makes you think, like, how tricky is it to really communicate these things in a way that everyone understands, you know?
Yeah.
Especially in law, where the words have so much weight.
Oh, absolutely. And it really gets you thinking, right? What does reasonable doubt actually mean to you personally? Is it a feeling, a certain level of certainty? I mean, even legal scholars are still debating it. It shows just how complex it is and just how important it is to our whole system.
Okay, let's tackle the last big part of Cotton's appeal, his sentence. He got 15 years for the robbery, and he argued that the judge went too far. What did the Idaho Supreme Court say about that?
Well, they started by pointing out that a 15-year sentence for robbery was absolutely within the legal limits in Idaho. So right off the bat, there's this presumption that the sentence is okay.
Unless there's some really strong reason to think the judge messed up, right?
Right. Cotton had to show that the judge abused their discretion when deciding on the sentence. And, you know, that's a pretty high bar to clear.
Yeah, what does that even mean? Abuse of discretion.
Well, in this case, Cotton didn't help himself because during the original sentencing, he didn't ask for probation or present any reasons why he should get a lighter sentence. What we call mitigating factors, you know?
Like things that might make his situation less serious.
Exactly. And the court pointed that out.
So you can't just appeal later and complain that the sentence is too harsh. You have to make your case at the trial level.
Right. If you want a specific outcome, you've got to give the judge reasons. Staying silent and then appealing later, it usually doesn't work. The appeals court, they look at what the trial court knew at the time.
So that's a good lesson for anyone going through the system. Be proactive.
Absolutely. Make your arguments, present your evidence.
Okay, so we've covered the three big legal issues that State v. Cotton brought up. But there are also some broader points about how the courts work and even some historical context that are worth mentioning.
For sure. Like, one thing this case really shows is the idea of standards of review. Appellate courts, like the Idaho Supreme Court here, they generally don't retry the whole case. They don't second guess the jury's findings or the trial judge's decisions on, you know, factual details or things where they have some leeway.
Right. They're mainly focused on whether the law was applied correctly.
Exactly. So unless there's a clear legal mistake or the judge went way beyond their authority, the higher courts usually defer to the lower courts.
They trust the process, basically.
Right. And then there's that phrase, infamous crime against nature. It's kind of a jarring reminder of how much things have changed. That was the legal term in Idaho back then for what we'd now call sodomy.
It reflects a different time, different attitudes.
Exactly.
So to wrap things up, what are the big takeaways from State v. Cotton? What should someone who's interested in law really take away from this case?
Well, first and foremost, it reminds us that the jury, they're the heart of our system. They decide what's true, even when the evidence is messy or contradictory.
Right. It's not the judge's personal opinion that matters.
And then there's that whole debate about reasonable doubt. This case shows us that even something so fundamental, so crucial to our idea of justice,
even that's open to interpretation, to debate.
Exactly. Even the most brilliant legal minds struggle with how to explain it perfectly.
And of course, there's the issue of sentencing. Judges have a lot of power there, but it's not unlimited. And if you're the defendant, you can't just stay silent and expect the best outcome. You've got to actively make your case.
Absolutely.
And lastly, the Idaho Supreme Court's decision in this case really highlights the fact that higher courts, they generally respect the decisions made by the lower courts. They won't overturn things lightly.
Right. It's all about ensuring the process was fair, that the law was followed.
But going back to reasonable doubt for a second, I think Justice Bisline's point really stuck with me. He suggested that maybe we overthink it. You know, maybe the meaning is there in the plain language.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thought.
So I'll leave our listeners with this. What does reasonable doubt mean to you? Not the legal definition, but just, you know, in your own words, in your gut. It's a powerful question to consider.
It really is. And it shows how, even in law, sometimes the simplest questions are the most profound.